I hope you're prepared, because I gave this assignment a long time ago. The story of the relationship between Yaakov and Leah. Alright, now that is to be found. Basically, it begins in chapter 29. Yaakov, you know the background of the story. Yaakov goes to the house of Lavan. He's, first of all, he's running away from Esav and also in search of a wife. And he meets Rachel, and obviously he likes her very much. And he makes a arrangement with Lavan to work 7 years. And he works 7 years. Then, you know, there's the element of the deceit. Love and deceives him. Major, he deceives him, right? Good time. And he substitutes Leah for Rachel, which is very strange. And Yaakov is not aware of this until the morning. The pasuk itself indicates it, because it says that in the morning, Vayiva Boker, that's 25, Chafei. It was in the morning and she was Leah. And Rashi points out, but in the evening it wasn't. What do you mean in the evening it wasn't? Meaning that he did not notice that it was Leah until the morning. And then he complains to Lavan. He had been deceived. And of course we learn that he had taken steps to protect himself. He already suspected. Where do we see that he suspected that Lavan would deceive him?
When he described it.
When he described, right. Rashi goes into that. Verse 29. In Pasuk 18, it says Yaakov loved Rachel, and he said, "I will work for you for 7 years." But Rachel bitcha ktana. Three words. You know, the Torah does not go into excessive description. He mentioned Rachel, your younger daughter, and Rashi explains all he had to say was Rachel. Yeah, with a normal person, that's all you would need to say. But he had to express it in all different kinds of ways, because you could have tricked him. If he would have just, Rashi says, he says, he knew that, why did he have to mention all these descriptions? He knew he was tricky. He said, if he just said Rachel, so then maybe he'd say a different Rachel. There's somebody else you're referring to. Therefore he said, your daughter. And if he would have said your daughter, then maybe he'd switch it with Leah and call her Rachel. So he had to make it airtight. And nevertheless, Rashi said he still faked him out. How did he fake him out? So Rashi points out, take a look at 28 in Rashi. It was in the morning, and behold, it was Leah. So Rashi says, but in the evening it wasn't Leah. Why? Because Yaakov had given signs over to Rachel. So Yaakov was very suspicious of this, and he had taken measures to protect himself. He gave signs over to Rachel. And when Rachel saw that they were bringing Leah in instead of her, she said, "Now my sister will be terribly embarrassed." So she got up and she gave her over the sign. So whatever they were, doesn't tell us, it's not important to know, but whatever the signs were, Rachel gave them to Leah to spare her the embarrassment. So therefore at night he did not know, but in the morning he saw. And nevertheless he had to make another agreement to work another 7 years. But he didn't have to wait another 7 years. He got married. The pasuk says, "Malei Shavu Azos." That's in 28. Actually, 27. So Lavan made up some kind of excuse. He said, "This is not the custom of the place to marry the younger before the older." He was a very deceptive, very shrewd person, and he fell back on this argument. That there was nothing he could do about it. This would be, but if you want, you can have Rachel He says, fulfill Shavuot. Shavuot does not mean 7 years here. It means this week of rejoicing. Not to, oh, that's a common mistake people make. In other words, it doesn't mean that he had to wait another 7 years. He didn't wait 14 years for Rachel. He worked 7 years for her. At the end of 7 years, he was supposed to marry her, but he was tricked, and he wound up marrying Leah. Then Laban gave him the excuse that it's not the custom of the place. But he said, wait out this week. This week meaning the 7 days of rejoicing. Because it wouldn't be right to marry another woman during the seven, you know, to take away from the rejoicing that's due to Leah. Then marry Rachel, and then you'll work 7 years. You understand? So it was sort of a compromise in the sense that he didn't have to wait another 7 years. He didn't have to wait another 7 years, but he did have to work another 7 years.
Well, why did he have to work another 7 years?
Well, that's why he was. It's a good point. It's a good point Renee is making. Why? Why? Renee is making a good point. He was cheating. He was cheating out and out cheating. Let's face it. He was cheated. Why did he have to even stay married to Leah? Or why did he have to work? He had worked for Rachel. This is a cheat. I worked for Rachel. What did he give me life for? Why did he have to work another 7 years? There's only one answer. Sometimes you lose. It was absolutely unfair. It was unjust. And he did it because he had no choice. Because we'll soon see. I mean, this is a very significant development. Very important step, not just in his life, but in the life of the Jewish people. And he had no choice. And when you have no choice, you got to grin and bear it. And you see, he didn't. We're living in a society where it's not fair. It's very often for injustice. Like, you know, you read the news, everybody has become a victim in our society, and everybody's screaming for justice. Like Zev said, just us. Just us. No, because you see, he's right. It's a good play, it's a good pun. Because most of these people that are screaming about justice, it turns out it's only for themselves, they're interested in. So any other group, even doing it, they don't mind, like people that are against the forest, for example. Which, man, I'm not getting into the whole issue. They dragged in one of the chief rabbis in Israel to get a psak on, furs. Because they kill animals. Yeah, you didn't even know. The furriers are up and up. One of the Sephardic rabbis, I think he's the chief rabbi, or a big rabbi in Israel, Sephardic rabbi, gave a psak that it's also to buy fur, mink, that kind of thing. Because they kill them in a cruel way. Well, you know how to kill animals in a cruel way. I'm not getting into the psak, but I'm saying that a lot of these people that advocate, what they do is they go to people in the city and they'll, spray on their. Where's the justice in that? I mean, you have no right to do that just because you're against what the, it's not the, first of all, it's not the fault. These people are not killing the animals and they may not even be aware of it. And whatever, even if they have not taken that step or made that decision, they are still a free society. They have the right to decide whether they want to purchase this or not purchase it. Who are you to destroy their clothing? Who gave you the right to do that? Even the chief rabbi in Pesach, I'm sure he didn't say that you have a right to go over and take away somebody else's garment if it's a mink. He may have just simply said that you shouldn't buy it. So you see that's not justice. Person, the same thing with Nahir. That's aggression. A lot of people utilize, they're looking for an outlet for their own aggression. So, a crusader, exactly. Yeah, this would be pro-abortion, anti-abortion. Both sides will do, they'll go to crazy extremes. And they don't mind. In the course of pursuing justice, they, can perpetrate many injustices. Yaakov, sometimes in life you have no choice. Sometimes you lose. And you're angry and you're frustrated and there's nothing you can do about it. And the best thing is to just move on. And it's exactly, this again shows us an element of Yaakov's perfection. He surveyed the situation. He realized there was nothing he could do. He wanted to marry Rachel. He thought that was a necessity, and so he agreed to work another 7 years. And nowhere do we see that he bears any grudge or anger about the whole thing. That's it. You cut your losses and move on. Now,
31.
One second. Yeah. Now, there's some problems over here. Let's get into some of the problems. There are two major problems that the shiur will revolve around, and then there's a number of minor issues. As the story proceeds, we get into now the two sisters, they're both married to Yaakov, and Leah says that God saw that she was hated. Okay? This is bothersome to us. Yeah, because we just got finished saying, well, first of all, we got finished saying that Yaakov accepted. He accepted the reality. But then says that Leah was hated, which indicates that he didn't accept the reality.
And also, it's
yeah, I want to get one of the main questions. It says that he, in verse 30, that he came to also to Rachel, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he worked another 7 years. Well, that indicates that he married her first. That possibly indicates that he married her, and then he worked. As we said, he married her after the 7 days. Then it says that God saw that Leah was hated and opened her womb, which means to say that she too would probably, all of the Yemos apparently had problems having children, and Rachel was barren. And then it goes to describe the children. Now the children, the naming of the children all reflect the idea that Leah's obsession, it seems like almost an obsessional need, that through the children somehow she's going to receive the love. He was terribly troubled by this fact, that he hated her. He said, God saw my affliction. Well, first of all, the question is like this. God saw that she was hated. There's a number of questions. First, the obvious question, how could Yaakov hate her? How could Yaakov hate Leah? Now, it doesn't make any sense. First of all, what kind of a woman was Leah? Leah was a tzaddikus. She was a righteous woman. She was one of the imahos. She was one of the mothers of the nation. She's buried in the Marat Machpelah. She was a great woman. She was on a high level. She had prophecy. She was a tzaddikus. So, it doesn't make sense. Well, how could he hate a person like that? How could Yaakov hate? We'll take that up in a second. All right, once again. How could he hate her? It's an issur of the Torah. Of course, this is before Matan Torah, but they lived in accordance with the precepts of the Torah, the moral. It says, Lo sisna es achicha b'levecha. You're not allowed to hate your brother. Now, brother here means fellow Jew, male or female, in your heart. So it's prohibition to hate a fellow Jew. You know that. And therefore, you know that if another Jew insults you or angers you or hurts you in any way, you're not allowed to hate them in return. What you're obligated to do is to rebuke. But if you fail to rebuke and you go around hating this person, then you're in violation. So it's a biblical violation to hate another Jew. If you find yourself in that situation, you're not obligated to rebuke, because if you forgive them in your heart, truly forgive them, not a fake forgive, you know, like I'm not angry at them. Yeah, it's got to be honest. If you truly forgive, you don't have to rebuke the person. If a person wrongs you, you do not have to rebuke them. But if you find that you're really angry at them, you really dislike them, you really hate them, then you must do something about that. You have to clear it up, clear up the air. And in fact, it's the famous Gemara in Kedushin. The Gemara in Kedushin says that a man can marry a woman personally or through his agent, just like a woman can marry, can accept the Kedushin personally or through a appointed shliach, which means that you really don't have to show up at the wedding. You don't have to, you could already, you could be in the honeymoon place already, you know, in Acapulco, and then you just have an agent that, you know, at the hall, and they, a man and a woman, right? I don't even know if that could be a man, because why? A man and a woman. A woman. The shliach can't walk in the shliach. Cannot be a woman. I'm wrong. I don't think so, but they. God, it sounds funny, but halachically it could be done. And no, they could have. No, the family could have the affair, the partner. You just get the phone call. Yes, the kedushin took place, and you know, the honeymoon can begin. The point of it is, though, nevertheless, it says that one should not do that. And it's not because you shouldn't deprive your parents of the nachas. The Gemara says, there's two reasons. One reason is that it's a mitzvah bo, yosin mibishlucha, he should perform the mitzvah himself. That since it's a halachic performance, it's a mitzvah, you should do the mitzvah yourself. Then the Gemara says it's also possible that it's not just for the sake of the mitzvah, but also that not failure to do so could involve an iser, a prohibition. It means if you get married by proxy, the assumption being you haven't seen the woman. Well, you just send a messenger to pick out a girl, you haven't seen her, then you might dislike her, and you might come to a violation. Now it'll be a violation of, thou shalt not hate thy brother in your heart. That'll be a violation. In other words, a man hates his wife. If a man hates his wife, then he's over on the diaresis. Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thy heart. So my question is, as you people have noticed, then how could it be? How could Yaakov hate Leah?
You know,
it says that God said that she was hated. Who was he referring to? And therefore God... By whom? Oh, no. It's a follow-up. It's a follow-up. No, it's a follow-up. The previous prophet said he loved Rachel more than Leah. And then it says that God saw that she was hated. And then look at what she says. God has seen my affliction. She named him Reuven. For she said, for God has seen my affliction. And now my husband will love me. Then she gave... Now this always struck me as being strange. First of all, what's the connection between the fact that she was hated and God opens her womb? And also now she thinks that as a result of this, he'll love her. And apparently it doesn't work. Because then it says she became pregnant again. And she says, upon you love the Ishi Eli, now my husband will cling to me, will be with me. Will cling to me. And she called him... I'm sorry, I skipped one. Now the next one is Shimon. After this, because God heard, he knew Anochi, that I'm hated. By Yaakov, of course. And he gave me also this one, and she called him Shimon. Right? And apparently this didn't work. And she had another child, and she said, this time my husband will be with me. Right? For I've given birth to three sons. So she's referring to her husband in all these things. Therefore, everything above refers to her husband. Therefore, she called him Levi. And then the fourth one is Yehuda. Now I'll give praise to God. It doesn't make any sense. Well, first of all, why this method would change anything doesn't seem to really... Right? It doesn't make sense on how... What would, if a person doesn't like somebody, the fact that this person has a child, I don't think it's going to change that. It's going to convert hate to love. Moreover, it didn't work the first time. An intelligent person makes a deduction. Obviously, there's something deeper than that, but no. She keeps going a second time. And then, it seems that, there's something even... Yeah, then the Shmacha, it's like a competition. And that, I'm not going to go into all... it's true. The whole thing is very strange. Yeah. This, well, I'm not taking up every aspect here. But the whole thing is very strange. It seems to be almost like a competition. And then she's jealous that she can't have Rachel without jealous. Why is she jealous? The whole jealousy, the competition, and then to do that in later on. I know, but don't expect me to take up every question today. Because hopefully... So that's very strange. That's very strange why Leah would act this way, and why she wouldn't make the deduction after the first instance that with Reuven it didn't change anything. So she continues to hope, and then with Shimon it says there's always something pathetic about it. It's sort of like it evokes a certain sense of sympathy. And whenever I read, very strong identification with one of the things in this story. It's sort of troublesome. You can identify the little drama over here. What else? Question. Along these lines, I think we have to ask, how could Leah, given the fact that we're saying that Leah was on a high level woman and she was a tzedekis, how could she participate in the deceit? Even though we're not justifying Yaakov's hatred, but there is no doubt that she, we have a question over here, that she is wrong for participating in the deceit, but right that she have to go along with it. It was her father's doing. But why didn't she protest or inform Yaakov as to what was going on? I mean, Rachel intervened to save her the embarrassment. But we would imagine that she had an obligation to step forward and to disagree with her father. I mean, there's such a thing as keep it up. It's very nice, but not to disagree. You're not obligated to honor your father and to perform it, and that doesn't give her the right. What right did she have to go along with it? And if you're going to say, as Chazal do, there is an opinion among Chazal, that's why he hated her. Which brings that into focus. That Yaakov only hated her because of the deceit. The trouble I have with that is that if so, he should have divorced her. He should have divorced her. Yeah, you're not allowed to stay married to someone that you hate. You're not allowed to hate a fellow Jew. You're not allowed, I mean, truthfully speaking, if a person is honest, if he finds himself hating his spouse or vice versa, a woman finds herself in this where she hates her spouse, then the logical thing to do is either to solve the problem between you or get divorced. It doesn't make any sense to stay in a situation of hatred. Now, a man like Yaakov either would have rebuked her, he would have straightened out the issue, either he would have found that it's inexcusable and divorced her, or he would have found that it's excusable. There is such a thing as she made a mistake. And then he would have excused her, and he would have forgiven her, and then you go on from there. So this does not answer the question as to what right did he have to hate her. But I'm only saying that we still have to ask the question, what right did she have to participate in the Ramos, in the deceit? Along those lines, however, having stated that question, this leads us to another question. Yeah? You can't have, it doesn't make sense, you can't have both ways. You can't say, well, I don't like her, but I'm going to be married to her because she's having children. It's like, you know, you're married to a girl from a rich, you know, who's very from a rich family. And you don't like her and all this, but you don't want to get divorced because of all the benefits. I mean, that's a low-level kind of thing. That's a low-level kind of a person.
He stayed with her.
What do you mean? She was his wife. Good point. Very good point. That's what the Torah says. That's a very good point. That's what the Torah says in the Parsha of Kisisa. That it's first it goes from Yifas Torah. If you marry Yifas Torah, that's a captive woman who you fall in love with, and she's not a Gentile, but the Torah permits you to take her in and to convert her and marry her. And it says you shouldn't do it, though. The Torah is against it. And then it says that if you have two wives, one who is beloved and one who is hated, and the Bechor is from the hated one, you have to give him the full rights of the Bechor, of the firstborn. And then the next parsha is the rebellious son. And Chazal said it's all connected, that if you do marry this Yifas Torah, this Gentile woman, in the end you're going to wind up hating her. It's just a momentary infatuation due to the war situation, which, you know, in general, most of these types of marriages they begin with infatuation, and in the end, it's not based upon the true love. You wind up hating her. And it says if you wind up hating her, you're going to have a rebellious child. Because if the parents are not united in raising the child, then it's going to lead to rebelliousness in the child. Because the child will always play off one parent against the other, basically. Now, so certainly, yeah, that's a problem. Why would he's not going to... Well, that's a very good point that Jackie's making. He's not going to build the nation, and these children are so important, on such a shaky foundation. It's absurd. That's not the type of marriage and home environment. But I was thinking of another question, because if we pursue the idea of the deceit, and we do say that Leah has to answer for herself over here, she does not have a right to do this, to go along just because her father was a cheater, to go along with the deceit. Okay, we'll take that up. Fine, but that doesn't give you a right to deceive somebody. Or to deceive you? No, she didn't deceive her. Then we have to ask a question about Rachel. What right did Rachel have to give away the Simon? Because in doing so, she was aiding and abetting a crime.
Kibud av
the aim does not stop.
No,
when your parents...
Ish
imo v'yavim tiro, a man shall, his mother and father fear, shall fear. V'yashab sosai tishmaru, and guard my Sabbath. Which teaches us a very, very important... That's another shiur, by the way. Sometime this year, maybe. That teaches us that what's the juxtaposition? That if your parents tell you to violate the Sabbath, then my honor comes before your parents. And that's not just the Sabbath, that's any violation. Which means to say that the obligation to honor your parents and fear your parents is only within the framework of Torah. If they tell you to do something which is against Torah, we have this all the time. Where children, not they've grown already, they want to not just go to college, they want to learn Torah for a few more years or whatever, and the parents insist that they leave the yeshiva, even if they're going to go to class, their queen is not good enough, they have to go through a better, you know. And we've had cases like that where parents actually pluck their children out of the yeshiva because they have to go to this, I'm not going to mention names, you know, prestigious schools, which is clearly against the Torah. Of course the Torah insists upon learning a parnasa, but that they could have learned in New York and while learning in yeshiva. In such a case, there's no chiyuv of kibbutz. There's no obligation of honoring your father and mother when they're telling you to do something which is against the Torah. So here there's no kibbutz anyways, because Lavan did not speak to Rachel, and Lavan didn't even know about this. But certainly, even if he did, she had no right to do it. And yet there's no indication that Yaakov was angry at Rachel for giving away the Simana. Now why would he give away? Of course he must have figured out that how'd she get the Simon? I assume that he figured that one out. So if we're going to say he was angry at Leah, why wasn't he angry at Rachel, who gave the Simon to him? Okay? I think that's enough questions, unless you have anything. There's an interesting Chazal that states as follows. Chazal say that once, when Yaakov saw the actions that Leah had done, that she had participated in the deceit, deceived her sister, then he thought about divorcing her. But once God enabled her to have children, blessed her with children, he said, "Shall I divorce the mother of these?" Interesting. A little bit different than what you're saying.
Where is it?
It's a Chazal.
Well, where's
your definition? Ramban quotes it.
Well, what happened?
That's one answer. I mean, there's other answers.
Well, also,
that he... It's funny. It says that he hated her because of her deceitfulness, what she had done. She participated. And he was thinking about divorcing her. But then when he saw that God was good to her and gave her children, then he said, "Shall I divorce the mother of these?" It requires further explanation. I'd like to address the question of the deceit. Why Leah participated in this deceit? She was a tzaddikah, a righteous woman. A righteous woman wouldn't do this. And also, if we can, up to a point, because certain things we just can't answer. Why did Yaakov favor? It's clear that Yaakov favored Rachel, Rachel over Leah. And why? Leah was a tzaddikah too. Is there anything that we can discover, anything that's overt or obvious that we could notice, a reason why you would prefer one over the other? Let's take a look at the Pesukim. To go back now to, I'm saying beforehand. Now he chose Rachel. He wanted to marry her. Take a look at, now we're going back to the original decision. He had a choice, obviously, between two. Take a look at 16. And Lavan had two daughters. 29. Lavan had two daughters. The name of the older one was Leah, and the younger one was Rachel. Now, this is very strange, the way it describes them. The eyes of Leah were dim, and Rachel was beautiful of form and beautiful of appearance. And Yaakov loved Rachel. And then he said, "I'll work 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter." It would seem from this that why did he love her more?
Because of
looks. That itself is a little bothersome to us. I mean, we're dealing now with Yaakov Avinu, who's on the highest level. And he wasn't even a youngster at this point. I believe he was about 84 years old. He was in his 80s at this point. Well, he was a, you know, an older man. That's the Torah is describing he had two daughters. There's a number of difficulties with the whole thing. First of all, it never says that, it would seem from the simplistic interpretation was that he favored her because she was the pretty one.
Yeah.
But why would a man like Yaakov be so impressed with looks? That's not the philosophy of Judaism. We don't place such an emphasis on looks. And it doesn't state, interestingly enough, it doesn't state that Leah was ugly in contradistinction to Rachel. It just says something about her eyes. Yeah, something with the eyes. I mean, what? If it wanted to say, you know, it wanted to make the point that Rachel was beautiful and Leah was ugly, it could have made the point. Right. Notice also that it mentions two terms. It says that Rachel was Yifas Tawar, Yifas Mara. Interesting, we just talked about the Yifas Tawar, that's the beautiful of form. Right? That's what I mentioned before. When you'll see in captivity a woman who's Yifas Tawar, the same term. Beautiful of form. But it doesn't say Yifas Mara. There's beautiful of form and beautiful of appearance. Here it's two terms. Why does it have to use two terms to describe her beauty? I'm sorry? The Torah over here, I don't think that the basis of the relationship between Yaakov and Rachel was like we would think, in the ordinary romantic, based upon the physical, the appearance, and the beauty. That type of thing. I mean, if you read it superficially, you could put that interpretation, but that's not what it was about. There's a lot of proof for that. I mean, first of all, you see that the pasuk says that he worked 7 years. What does it say? And it wasn't his eyes as just a few days, because it was great love for her. Now that sounds strange, because you would think it's just the opposite. When a person is very much in love with someone. So then 7 years is an extremely long time. It works just the opposite. The more in love you are, then the longer it seems to be. Here it says that it seemed like a very short period of time due to his great love. It's just the opposite. When you're very much in love, it seems like forever. What does it mean? It means in terms of her value. Due to the love, but the love was how he valued her. So therefore, for relative to how valuable she was, how great a woman she was, it seemed like a very small price to pay. That's what it means. But it doesn't mean to say that he was caught up in the grip of romantic fervor. If that's the case, then it wouldn't have seemed like a short period of time. Now, what attracted him to her? Why Rachel? It says that the eyes of Leah, what were they dim about? What does it mean? So Rashi says that she was crying. Why was he crying? She thought that she was going to be in the Goral, that she was going to fall into the lot of Esav, and she cried because everybody said that this is a shidduch, right? He has two sons, Rivka has two sons, and Lavan has two daughters. So the older one will go to the old. In other words, Rashi is saying that she thought that she'd wind up with Esau. Okay, I mean, that's not, I don't know if that has to be taken literally, but for one thing it tells you is what you said. The fact of the matter is that what the Torah is telling you is about the eyes is that she had a certain sadness. Let's take the smallest step. She was sad. She was sad. Well, relax. She was sad. Now, why she was sad? She had a certain sad. All right. So Rashi, I don't take things so literally. You know what I mean? That she thought was she thought that she was going to wind up. I mean, so why did she thought? She didn't have to marry Esau. In fact, doesn't even come close to marrying it. There's a way you can avoid marrying Esau. I mean, even then there was free will, there was free choice. She wasn't living in a prison. So don't marry Esau. Yeah, so don't marry Esau. You marry somebody else. See, on the contrary, Rachel had something else about her. I don't know what's the word. She had like this. There are two things. Yefastor refers to the form, Torah's form. Now, as Malki said before, in terms of looks, what makes a person attractive, certainly there's such a thing as looks. I mean, even objectively, there's certain people that are, you know, shaped properly, look good, good looking, whatever you call good looking. But looks per se, there's another element, and it's hard to define. I don't want to get too much, you know, you've all mentioned it. But there's something, a certain personality that shines through, a certain element that radiates. And that's, I think, much more significant in making a person attractive. I know what you call a thing, there's a, you know, this person has a thing, a certain glow. That stems from a certain inner happiness and contentment. And people, because you'll find there are a lot of people that, if you look at their features, they have very good looking features, but they're not really that attractive, for some reason or other. And other people that are not that good looking, but people are drawn to them. And they find them very good, very pleasant to look at. Because on the psychological level, that element is of happiness, a certain inner happiness and contentment is much more attractive. I think that's why it mentions two things. She had beauty. And beauty, we said, was important for the Imams and their role, the role they played vis-a-vis the world. That the world was attracted, was much more influenced by the philosophy because they were good-looking people. But as far as Yaakov is concerned, the physical element was not the important thing. It mentions also the appearance factor. That's why by the Yefas Toar it just mentions the physical, because that's just a physical attraction. That's why it doesn't last. What? Yeah, Leah could have been. It doesn't say that she wasn't, that she was ugly. Exactly. But she did not have that same glow, and apparently it's not because she was lacking in perfection. She was a perfected person, but she was troubled by things. She had a certain sadness about it, and that sadness did have to do with it. She was worried, and she was worried about what kind of a shit-off she would get. Maybe she was lacking confidence. Maybe she had reasons to believe she wouldn't get Yaakov, but she was worried. And that took away from her personality, her attractiveness. Take a look back when Yaakov first sees Rachel. Go back to 10, verse 10. He had come back to the area, and he was by the bear, and he was talking to the shepherd. And when Yaakov saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, the brother of his mother, and the sheep of Laban, and he approached and he removed the stone from the bear. And this was a tremendously heavy stone, because they had to wait for all the shepherds to come there. So all of a sudden, Yaakov removes this tremendously heavy stone, and he waters the sheep of Laban. Then it says he kissed Rachel, and he lifted his voice and he cried. This is a very unusual kind of a thing. Yaakov, it's hard to associate this with a great tzaddik. Here he meets Rachel. He hasn't even said a word to her. Then he talks. First he's like smitten with her. It seems to be very, very romantic if you take it superficially. Like he's smitten with her and he's infused with this tremendous strength and he removes the stone. And then he kisses her. Now kissing is the most troubling of all. Where's the sneers? Sneers, kissing, it's not even the first date. I mean, even on, you know... It's not right. It's not proper. It's immodest. It seems to be lacking in modesty. Okay, you know, like it says by Abraham, he didn't know your dad. When they were on the road down, he says, "Now I know that you're a beautiful woman." Now, I mean, all along he didn't even notice that Sarah was beautiful. Didn't even notice such precious, such tenia, such modesty. And here, this is Yaakov Avinu. It's shocking. And he just meets her. He didn't even say hello to her, and he kisses her. And that gives you the right to kiss with Yaakov. We can't project our own emotions onto Yaakov. I mean, it's not the kind of kiss that you would think it is. Absolutely not. And as I said, you see the proof. The proof of the matter is that he worked for 7 years. And it seemed like a small amount in his eyes. It was nothing. He didn't hang out with her during those 7 years. But also, take a look at what the language that he uses. Shocking language. Another thing that's shocking.
When he did,
one says, and this is 21. And Yaakov said to Lavan, "Bring me my wife, for I fulfilled my days, that I may come unto her." Which means, which is a very blunt expression. In other words, it's as if to say that I may have relations with her. And Rashi speaks about this and says, "How does he talk this way?" 1 second. But the expression, you don't talk to a father-in-law that way. Rashi says like this. He says, "Vavoela." He says, "Valo kal sheva kalim ain't all we can." The lowest of the low don't speak this way. Even the low level people don't speak this way. They don't bring me my wife that I may have relations with her. But lahol is toldos amakah. It means to say that his whole purpose was for the sake of having children, for the sake of Klal Yisrael. That's all he was involved in. If that is the case, then it's not the kind of love that we're talking, that you would imagine. He did love her. He did love her, but the basis of the relationship between the Avos and the Imos was completely different than anything we're accustomed to. That is expressed by Abraham and Sarah. You see that? "Behold, now I know that you're a beautiful woman," which means that until the situation when they were going down to Egypt, he hadn't taken notice of her beauty. What do you mean he hadn't taken notice? He knew objectively that she was beautiful. It meant to say that was not the basis of the relationship. Which means that they partook of an entirely different kind of a love. It was love, but it was a different kind of love. How would you characterize that love? And give me an example. Where else in Tanakh do you find a description that's akin to that kind of love? I would say David and Yonasan. It says that David loved Yonasan Kenafsho. The Nafsho Kshura, the souls, it was a different kind of love. The kind of love is really, it's based upon the recognition of the other person's Tzelem Elokim, as a Tzelem Elokim. There's two types of love. There's instinctual love, that's what we refer to. In this society, that's the whole value, the ultimate value, instinctual love, romantic love, which has nothing to do with the objective character of the other person. The person thinks the other person is wonderful, but it's just his emotions that are telling him that. That's the instinctual, and you see, it's not based upon a true appreciation of the virtue of the other person, because it happens instantaneously. You know, you hear it, that's what they tell you, and they tell you you should really follow that, which is really insane. Now, you see another person, and you hear bells, it triggers off certain emotions, and psychologically, we can understand why this occurs. That is not the kind of love that's why that type of thing is a very short duration. And that's why it says also with Yitzhak and Rivka, it says Vatilo Isha Vayehada, and she became his wife and he loved her. First she became his wife and then the love. The more he knew her, the more he lived with her, and he began to appreciate her virtue. It was, the love was based upon an appreciation of virtue. This type of love is possible only to people of great virtue, for whom, who are in search of the good, of the real good. I would say it's only people who have a true relationship to Ahavat Hashem, to the love of God, and therefore what they, their whole relationship to other people, so that's why this love can occur between David and Yonasan. The love that one tzaddik would have for another is based upon this person's tremendous appreciation of the Tzelem Elokim, of human virtue. Because the closer he gets to God, he appreciates that we're supposed to emulate the ways of God. So the more he perfects himself, the more he obtains an appreciation for the real virtues. And then when he sees another Tzelem Elokim who is an embodiment of these virtues, though, he automatically is drawn to that person. That's a different kind of relationship. That's the relationship that that David had with Yonatan. You understand? Now that is the real love. The Torah does believe in love. That we talk about love. And it's a very fulfilling, it's the most fulfilling type of human relationship. I'm not saying it's the ultimate experience for a person, that love is the highest good in this world. We don't believe that. But it is a very fulfilling kind of an experience. But it's not the type of love that people talk about. Love and marriage in American society. That type of thing is basically just an instinctual thing, and it doesn't work. You see now outside today, it doesn't work because you have like 50-60% divorce rate, and all these marriages are based upon that principle, by and large. I'll ask you, what about throughout all of history? Why the divorce rate wasn't that high until recently? It's only because there were societal factors then that made it, you know, we're living in the me generation, and you know, people have freedom, more freedom to do whatever they please, and there's no societal taboo. But that type of love doesn't really last. This I would say, and I'm just describing it very roughly. I don't mean to say that I've really hit the essence of it. I'm just describing it roughly. This is the type of love that the Avos had with the Imam. It was not based upon the instinctual. So you'll ask me, if that's the case, you know, can any tzaddik love, you know, can you just arrange a marriage, any tzaddik love any tzaddikus? If that's the case, is it purely... I mean, David Yonasan, so why David Yonasan? Then Yonasan wasn't the only virtuous person. Is this something which is going to occur between any two virtuous people? I would say no. I would say that any tzaddik will have an appreciation of another tzaddik, of a good person, but that would not, because you can't negate the factor of personality. Because it does, there is such a thing as the personality of a tzaddik. See, there is someone you like, when you enjoy another person, and you like a person, there is the element of a friend. You have acquaintances, and you have friends. Now, you can have acquaintances with people who are highly virtuous. The fact that this one is your friend is not because he's more virtuous than the other person. To make a friendship means that there are certain elements in terms of the emotions, in terms of the personality that you do have in common, that you enjoy, that you appreciate. That's the other thing is the personality, or the factor. But, you see, when those come together... When you're able to have that type of a relationship with someone who really embodies the values that you have and the virtues and is based upon chachma and learning together, then you have a fantastic relationship. You see? So the essence is really the appreciation of the virtue, the appreciation of the chachma. You have what to relate to each other. But the ability to enjoy it is, you see, on the personal, the emotional level, has a lot to do with personal things. And that nobody can have a claim on. You see, that's something which you can't demand of anybody else. That's just something, you know. And it's not something you always can have, by the way. That's a tremendous. I guess this is a matter of personal experience. Having. There's a lot of personal factors over here, and I don't want to reveal too much personal. You know, it's not that good. But I happen to think that the more you get involved in learning, I could be wrong about this, this is a personal thing. The more you get involved in the enjoyment of learning, the less social. I mean, I know for a fact that, for example, some occasionally, like friends that I went to high school with, and I was a totally different person than then.
The disclaimer.
Totally different person then. With different values. But occasionally, like a friend will call, it's very hard, you know, like it's very hard for me to maintain any kind of a friendship. See, they want to get together and, you know, a reunion kind of thing. Like, I don't go to any kind of reunion because I find I have nothing in common with them. I was a different person. And of course, I went to Torah Das, I was Orthodox and all that, but I didn't have the same values. I was just nominally, you know, Orthodox. But in terms of values, those weren't my real values. Later on, I got involved in learning and appreciation. Now my whole interests are completely different. I can't relate to these people other than in a very perfunctory kind of way. I find that it really narrows the field. It's very hard to talk to the average individual who has the ordinary value. It's very hard because what's there to talk about? What are you going to talk about? And it's the only person you can have a relationship with is someone with whom you can you know, discuss the things that really matter, ideas and Torah, and even if you're not talking about Torah. I'm not pretending that the only thing I ever talk about is Torah, but even if there's a certain approach you have already. Yeah, there's a certain approach you have. Whatever you discuss, any subject, even the most trivial thing, you're going to approach it with a certain intellectual kind of a way, an analytical way, and make certain points. And it's going to tie into the philosophy. Sooner or later, it's going to come into a point. And if the other person can't appreciate that, then, you know, you're talking at him, he's talking at you. There's no... So it narrows the field. And then even amongst those people, like, for example, the people in the yeshiva. So I can enjoy having a discussion with just about anyone, because... you know, they all appreciate chachma. But then, to be a personal friend, a close friendship, that requires more elements. Even because there are some people that are, you know, you have to maintain a certain distance from them, whatever. I mean, you know, on the emotional level, it's not the same. But to have someone that you can really connect with on the personal, emotional, and at the same time to share the intellectual, to me, I think that's like a... it's not something you can always count on. You know, it's like a blessing. It's like a very rare kind of a thing. That's what I find in my life. It's the loneliness. I would think that's what it means. In other words, he valued Rachel on two bases, because of her great qualities, her virtues that he saw in her, but also there was something that personal level. I think that glow. The chain that she had, the personality. All of these virtues didn't just exist in a vacuum, but they expressed themselves in a certain personality to which he was very attracted. And he loved her. And that was it. See what I'm saying? And that was the kiss. It's only because he was on such a high and exalted level. It was in the same way, do you remember we mentioned that when Moshe had the reunion with Yisro, I think they had a friendship. It said he bowed to him, Vayishak lo, and he kissed him. I would say that was the same kiss. It was a kiss of value and friendship. It has nothing to do with anything sexual. It's not the same kind of kiss that we were talking about before, like a boy and a girl on a date. It wasn't that romantic kind of a kiss. It was because you see that he was infused with a tremendous exhilaration, and then he cried. It was happiness that he had encountered someone. That he had encountered someone that embodied all of these virtues, and there was also that personal kesher. Now, you see, it mentions both daughters. The Torah mentions both daughters, and he loved Rachel. Leah had a certain dilemma. Leah, he did not feel the same way about. Leah, I'm sure he respected. He respected, because Leah had the same virtues, as far as we know. There's nothing to indicate that she wasn't virtuous. She was a great woman. She was a tzaddikus and all that. But that doesn't mean he's going to love her. He can respect her. See, so but... in marriage, it's more than that. There is the satisfaction of a certain personal emotion. That satisfaction of the personal he found with Rachel. That was the one that he wanted. Okay, we're going to get to that. We're going to get there. Right, we're going to get that. One thing at a time. One second. See, but Rachel found herself in a certain dilemma. What was Rachel's dilemma? See, we have to be Malama Tchus over here. We have to Malama Tchus. I mean, not Rachel, excuse me, Leah found herself in a dilemma. Leah found herself in a dilemma. I'm sorry? No, Rachel was fine. Rachel was a great woman. Rachel had what she wanted. Rachel wanted Yaakov, and Yaakov wanted Rachel. Everything was perfect. And they worked out their little secrets. They had their secrets. Everything was worked out perfectly. But Leah had a tremendous dilemma. What was the dilemma? She was unhappy. She was unhappy. And she desperately wanted to be part of what Rachel was involved in. Her mother's Klal Yisrael. She wanted to be involved in that because of her tremendous perfection. And there's two things. Do you remember? When Sarah gave Hagar to... It says she took her with words. Yeah, how fortunate you are to cling to Guf Kadosh, to cling to this holy person. She wanted to partake of that relationship. And apparently, whether you take it literally that she thought she was destined for Asimov, whatever it was, she didn't find too many men in that. She hadn't met encountered too, the prospect didn't look too good for her to find that kind of a relationship, that kind of a man. So she wants to be with Yaakov because she wants to be involved in fulfilling God's plan of setting up Klal Yisrael. She wants it very much. And she wanted to be involved with that kind of a man. She needed it. She was a tzaddikus. She was a perfected individual. But she had a tremendous need for the love of Yaakov. But unfortunately, it wasn't to be. That's why I remember the case, unrequited love. It wasn't to be. You can't always demand it, and you can't always count on it. It wasn't. See, a person can't make a demand on somebody else's love. You can't say that's something you can't demand. You can't demand that somebody else should love you. Now, what about the Rav Mollis? And what about the Snua? Let's go from here to the Snua. Jackie had answers for the hatred. Alright, Jan?
Hated.
I tend to agree with Jackie on this one. Take a look at the Pesukim. It never says that he hated her.
I mean, anger.
It says, what's that? It says, he came unto Rachel, and he loved also Rachel more than Leah. It says that he loved Rachel more than Leah. That's not the same thing as saying he hated her.
But then later on.
One second. What I'm saying is like this. Yaakov did not hate, in my opinion, Yaakov did not hate Leah. If he hated Leah, he either would have straightened out the situation or he would have divorced her. I'm not saying he was thrilled with what happened, but he didn't hate her. It says God saw Kisnua Leah. God saw that Leah was hated. What does that mean? I think it's what Jackie said before. Just, you know, think back into your own past, your own experiences. Let me repeat it. When a person desperately wants someone to love them, when you're in love with someone else, right, and the other person doesn't love you the way you want to be loved, and love somebody else, in fact, the way you would like to be loved, then you perceive that as hatred. People get upset when, even friends, when the friend doesn't respond, this and that, they'll over-exaggerate. They'll say that first she's cold to me, she's not friendly, she's this, she's that, and then you analyze what you do. It turns out they're not very trivial things. You see, it's relative to the fact that you have such a need. When you have a tremendous need for the other person's approval, like a student has a tremendous need for the teacher's approval, so the teacher can be treating you just ordinarily, you'll say that now. Say she hates me, doesn't like me. She just never gives me any credit. But you'll say, but objectively speaking, she's treating you. The thing is, it's perceived as dislike because of the tremendous need that you have. See, when you feel a tremendous need for somebody else's love, then if the other person is just treating you in a regular way, you have a tendency to over-exaggerate it. So Kisnua, God saw that she was Snua. She perceived herself as being hated. Not that he was hating her. He simply loved. He didn't, I don't know if he tried to hide it or not tried to hide it. It's very hard to hide those kind of things.
But it's just
he didn't love. God saw
Kisnua
Leah, that Leah perceived herself as being Snua. God didn't say that God saw that Yaakov hated her. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that Yaakov didn't hate her. Yaakov loved Rachel more than Leah. Period. He didn't hate her. But for Leah, that was sufficient to give her a feeling of being hated. God saw that she felt hated. What means it's describing how she felt. Because we're talking about how she felt. She felt hated. That's why God gave her a child, to make her feel better. So we're talking about how she felt. Now, if I say that this one is a snua in the sense that she feels hated, that doesn't mean that objectively she's hated. Right?
Yeah, if you look at 32, because it says...
That's all it means. There's no proof from that statement that she was in fact hated. It meant that she felt like she was hated. She felt into him. Any person that has a tremendous need.
But that's the whole point. She has that need, and that's what created this whole situation.
Now, God had mercy on her. Let me just finish the point. God had mercy on her. God had mercy on her. Why did God have mercy on her? And why did God enable her to have children? And why did she... Why was it okay that she had done this terrible thing? She had been involved in this. Yeah?
I can't even say
I would say like this. I'm not. This is This is the Ramban. Ramban says, I think, I don't know if he's quoting Chazal, but it makes a lot of sense. He says, like this, V'alokim yodea, God knew, that she did this, she participated in this deceit because she wants to be married to the tzaddik. Which means like this, that God forgave her because her motives were l'shem shemayim. Even though what she did was wrong. Now I'm not drawing any conclusion from this, because you're not allowed to do something which is wrong is wrong, and the end, we don't believe the end justifies the means. So I'm not saying that you can go ahead and do something even though it's wrong because your motives are the same shemayim. We're dealing with a case which is before the Tariq mitzvahs and so forth. True, she had no right to do what she did, but nevertheless God knew that her motivations were pure. She really, objectively speaking, deserved to be one of the imams. She deserved to be one of the ones. She deserved to be involved in the building of Klal Yisrael. The only thing is that you can't control human emotions. Yaakov didn't choose her. And really, she had no right. What she did was wrong. But nevertheless, she was deserving of being forgiven. Apparently her need was very, very great. We can't judge her. Apparently her need for this, I compare it with Chana. And Chana also uttered even threats to God. If you don't give me a child, her need was overwhelming. So, the thing that she wanted was for a proper reason, was for the sake of heaven. And the need was overwhelming. Look, we read in the Torah. I would say it's in the Hanistaros, it says Haniglos, Loyalanenu, the revealed things we're responsible for. Hanistaros, the hidden things is for God. That is to say, that God forgives the person. We can't judge. There's din v'cheshbon. Even if a person doesn't have error, but God will judge. If God sees that there was a situation where the person simply had no ability to, the need was so great that the person had no choice in the matter, whatever, so God will forgive. That's the Nisaros. Well, that's something else. No. That's where she had a claim on him in terms of justice. She had an obligation. She had no claim on Yaakov. She had no claim whatsoever. No, Leah had no claim because she had no right to do it. I don't mean to in any way justify what she did was wrong. I'm merely saying that even though she did something wrong, it doesn't mean that she's not a tzaddikus and she's not deserving. She did it. Yaakov apparently was disturbed by this. Yaakov was disturbed by what happened, but he knew that she was a great woman. He knew that she was a tzaddikus, and from the Chazal indicates that he wasn't sure what to do. He was thinking about, should he keep her, should he divorce her? Once he saw that she had children, then he knew that her motivation was for the sake of heaven, because he knew that his life at this point was completely under the God's providence. That getting married and so on and so forth was completely under God's providence for the sake of building Klal Yisrael. So therefore he knew that if God enabled her to have children, then she must be a righteous woman, and he forgave her. He never hated her in the first place, but he forgave the deceit and he accepted it. So why did she persist? According to my interpretation, that he really did not hate her. It's just that he loved Rachel more. So why did she persist with every child? And she kept, it's almost pathetic, she kept getting her hopes up and her expectations, and now he'll love me, and now he'll this, and now he'll... It seems to me, because that's what that only indicates, that, as I said, she was perfected, she was righteous, she was involved in the true good, but there was one thing that she needed to have that emotional satisfaction, and that was the love of Yaakov. See, God gave her the child because God saw that she felt hated, and God knew that she was a tzaddikus, and God wanted her to feel good so that she could participate. One thing God could do for her, you can't participate in building up Klal Yisrael, but be happy with that. The other thing I can't do for you, that's not in the cards. Sometimes you just have to accept that situation. You can't always have something just because you want it and just because you're entitled to it. She certainly was entitled to his love because she was a righteous woman, but love has nothing to do with entitlement. You can You could want to have a friendship with a tzaddik, with a great person. You want to be their best friend. You're entitled to. You have all the virtues, and yet and be much better than the one that they're friends. But you have no claim on that. You can't claim somebody else's love. That's free choice. You know that's something you can't. Her mistake was this. She believed that even she understood that Yaakov loved Rachel more, that Yaakov didn't love her, but she believed that that wasn't an inherent thing. She believed that it was subject to change. That Yaakov's attitude could be subject to change. That Yaakov didn't know. That Yaakov maybe blamed her. Maybe Yaakov blamed her. Or Yaakov didn't appreciate her value. And therefore, she felt that if Yaakov would really see her true value in terms of her role of building Klal Yisrael, then his attitude, his emotional attitude would change. That's why she kept hoping for children. And every child, and she maybe, but he'll see it more children. The more he'll see my role, it'll have an effect and it'll change his attitude. That's the element which is a bit pathetic, in other words, in a sense, which is tragic. She kept hoping that that a change could be effectuated in his attitude, but she didn't know it was impossible. It wasn't even within his control. It was not in this situation. It's possible sometimes, yes, but not in this situation. She didn't understand that the elements which determined Yaakov's emotional attitude towards Rachel could not be duplicated. It was something which he couldn't have. He had to give it up. Sometimes the person, and that's the tragic element, that's a tragic element, but it's not a tragic element in the true sense, because it's only tragic. See, this would be called a tragedy in America, if you have a movie about this, because if you believe that this is the ultimate value, the romantic, or the love relationship, even this kind of a love relationship, then a person is being consigned to a life of unfulfilled. But no, she was fulfilled. Because the true good is Ahavas Hashem. And she did benefit from the relationship with Yaakov. And she did participate in the building of Klal Yisrael. And she had a good life, and she was fulfilled. But there was an element which would have added a tremendous dimension, which would have made her happier on an emotional level, but that she couldn't have. That wasn't in the cards. I would like in another shiur to take up, I have a theory as to the effect this might have had on Reuven, because I want to do the character of Reuven, and I think to a certain extent that Reuven was affected by this. But one second. I'm not finished yet. Let me finish. What about Rachel? If we said before that Yaakov did blame her, Yaakov was angry with her about the deceit, he subsequently forgave her when he saw that God allowed her to have children, so therefore he understood that she did it for the right reasons. But what right did, why wasn't he angry with Rachel? What about Rachel? Why did Rachel have a right to do what she did? Because Rachel was also part of the conspiracy. And by Leah, now we're saying by Leah, that Leah had this tremendous need. She had this tremendous emotional need for the love of Yaakov. And even though it doesn't justify it, I'm saying that, yeah. I would say, the way the situation set itself up, apparently she didn't know he was very shrewd love until the last minute. At that point she wants to, Chazal said that she wants to save him from embarrassment. Which means that Rachel acted purely out of an emotion of compassion. So you see, she gave up, she was willing, she didn't know that at this point she could have lost Yaakov. But she was willing to give up her own happiness in life to spare her sister from that public embarrassment is the worst thing of all. That's what Chazal say. Chazal say that public embarrassment is the worst thing of all. That's what David, they used to taunt David after the situation with Bathsheba. Right? And they used to, he didn't commit adultery, but it appeared that way. So they used to ask him to embarrass him in the form of a question. The person who commits adultery, what death penalty is again? So he answered, the death penalty is chenek, choking. But one who embarrasses his friend in public does not have a share in the world to come. Because that can have a devastating effect. He understood her nature, her personality. To suffer that type of humiliation and an embarrassment could have been totally devastating. So Rachel acted purely out of compassion. And therefore Yaakov didn't blame her. She may have. You're asking a particular. You're asking a particular. So I mean, the only thing I could say, I can't get into the particulars of how the night set itself up. I will, you know, that's to give us that information.
But that would be
I understand. No. But if she would have known, if she could have headed off the development, if she could have headed it off, I'm sure she would have. But the way it set itself up, it must have been that she couldn't have. I don't know why. I can't answer that question. I don't have the facts. But I'm saying, because why would she? I can forget about saving the wife for her own benefit. Why wouldn't she? You know, warn Yaakov in advance. Yeah. So, my understanding, this is my own understanding, it's not something I've read anywhere, it's just my opinion. So you can take it at face value, at dead value, You don't have to accept it. My opinion is that he regarded what Rachel did from a different standpoint, that Rachel was acting out of compassion to save another individual from a devastating embarrassment, which Rachel felt would have destroyed her. Leah, he felt, was acting for selfish reasons, and that she should not have gone along with the deceit of her father, and therefore he was upset and disturbed and angry at her. Didn't hate her, I said, but angry at her. Until the situation clarified later on, it became clear that she did the wrong thing, but her motivations were totally l'shem shemayim, and God had forgiven her, and then he changed his attitude towards her. But as far as the love is concerned, that she can never win. Because that has nothing to do, you see? Yeah, that, exactly, well, right, exactly. There's a subjective element in love. With a tzaddik, it's different. Because it's not completely irrational, impossible. The tzaddik cannot love irrationally. That I don't believe. No, I don't believe that the love of a tzaddik is not irrational. If you put it, blatantly. Because a tzaddik can only love someone who is good. And that's why we have to hate our molech. And certainly, you read about these cases where people fall in love with killers and this and that and criminals and all that. And they said, nobody seems to think there's any problem with that because, well, love is love. Well, I can't help it. I love. I don't believe in that. How can you love? I don't understand how a person can love another person who's corrupt. I don't understand it. Because, how can you? If you value the good, how can you love someone who's evil? I don't understand how that's possible. Unless you're saying a person is purely functioning on a very base instinctual level. So, and Yaakov certainly cannot love irrationally. Yaakov can only love someone who was on a very high level and partook of perfection. But I will agree with Jan that there are elements in love, since it is a personal thing, that are purely subjective, that are purely emotional. It's how your emotions set themselves up, and your emotions will click with somebody else's emotions. That's something that you have no control over, and that element has to be present. That I will agree. But that alone wouldn't be sufficient. That's an accident. That's an act. That links up with the other elements, with the objective elements. That he had towards Rachel, that he did not have towards Leah. And that couldn't change. Leah believed it was possible to change. She had a tremendous need for it. That's why she keeps, you see, not just a need for it emotionally, but she also recognized there's tremendous benefits in that. I don't want to make it seem that it's just an emotional thing. To have that kind of a relationship, to cling to tzaddikim, it's a mitzvah. To have that kind of, I don't want you to think that Leah just wanted it for that, it was just common emotion. But she understood that there's a certain benefit in having that kind of a relationship. It's more, it's not just that you're emotional, but to have that kind of a relationship enables you to partake of some of the chachma of the person, of the insight of the person. It's a spiritual experience as well. It's just natural. You're going to share. You're going to share things with someone that you have that close, and you're not going to share with somebody else. There's benefits to be obtained in terms of your perfection. That closeness will enable you to partake. If you could have that kind of a closeness, if you were fortunate enough to have that, if you have a relationship with a gadol hador, with a girl, with a tremendous talmid chacham, that you can call him and talk to him on the phone, that's very good. You can talk to him, this, that, that's one. If you happen to like you on a personal level and one likes to schmooze with you when you meet with him a few times a week, how much more so? Just by, wouldn't that extra closeness, not just that you would enjoy it, but look how much you'd gain. You'd see him in different situations and he'd reveal things to you, open up things to you, things he can't tell a stranger. There's a benefit to be obtained from that. So, that's the